This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 24th of February 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello from Midori House in London, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, Russia's Prime Minister calls Ukraine's new leaders armed mutineers, Turkey sees fresh protests, and President Museveni of Uganda passes a law that criminalises homosexuality. I'll be joined by Gavin McFadgen and Jeffrey Kaufman in the first half of the show to discuss all of this and more. Then, our correspondent in Caracas, Irene Caselli, will bring us up to speed on the protests in Venezuela. And we'll speak to the producer behind an Oscar-nominated documentary about this lady.
Every day in life is beautiful. Every day. It's beautiful.
That's Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, right now. So lots for you in the next hour here on Midori House. But before any of that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
Ukraine's Interior Ministry says a warrant has been issued for the arrest of the former President Viktor Yanukovych. He's been removed from power and is wanted after ordering the crackdown on protesters last week that led to more than 70 deaths. The 63-year-old fled the capital Kiev by helicopter and is still at large after heading first to his eastern power base and then diverting south to the Crimea. While Monocle's Gulliver Cragg is in Kiev, he says the role of the country's former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko is unclear after her release from prison.
The tone of Yulia Tymoshenko's speech when she made her comeback on the Saturday evening was pretty clear that she intends to return to the forefront of politics, and that's not what the majority of Ukrainians want, I think. Certainly almost everyone I've been speaking to thinks that's a very worrying development, most people say quite clearly these people did not die for Yulia Tymoshenko.
The Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi promised to cut labour taxes, free up funds for investments in schools, and pass sweeping institutional reforms ahead of a confidence vote in his newly installed government on Monday. Facing Parliament for the first time, 39-year-old Renzi, Italy's youngest ever Prime Minister, detailed an ambitious programme of change in an hour-long speech delivered in his trademark quick-fire style. Backed by his own centre-left Democratic Party, the small centre-right NCD Party, centrists and other miscellaneous groups, he should win the vote in the 320-seat upper house, which is due in 3 hours' time. That's 2100 GMT. Joint military exercises involving the United States and South Korea are underway despite protests from North Korea, which described the manoeuvres as a rehearsal for an invasion. They started as more than 300 South Koreans met family members in a North Korean resort. John Everard is a former British ambassador to North Korea, and he said that the US Secretary of State John Kerry was keen to see the military exercises continue without giving in to the North.
There's a lot of playing of face going on here, that a lot of what the North wanted was just a symbolic session on the part of the South, showing that the North did have some kind of say over what happened on the ground in these exercises. Equally, the South was quite determined that should not happen, and I'm sure that Kerry would have reinforced that message.
Greece has resumed bailout talks with its international lenders today, hoping to end 6 months of wrangling over the release of new rescue loans it needs to avoid default. As the meeting of the three inspectors with the country's finance ministers began in Athens, laid-off government workers protested outside, forcing the troika to enter through a side entrance of the finance ministry. The review by the European Union, the European Central Bank and the International Monetary Fund has dragged on since September, with disagreements about the extent of savings and reforms Athens must make to comply with the terms of its bailout. And finally, in Australia, police are still hunting thieves who've made off with a 7-ton, 32-foot-high mango. The giant piece of fruit disappeared from a site in North Queensland. The area is known as the mango-growing capital of Australia, and the big mango was installed back in 2002. Well, Paul McLaughlin is chairman of the local tourism organisation, and he says so far their search has proved literally fruitless.
The girls rang me this morning when they come to work. It was definitely here yesterday. And when they've come to work this morning, they've have informed me the big mango's gone missing, so I come out and sure enough, it's no longer there. It weighs 7 tonne, this thing, and it's 3 stories high, 10 metres high and 7 metres wide, so it certainly wouldn't have been an easy prank.
And that bizarre story ends this bulletin of Monocle 24 News.
Well, we certainly bring you all the news, don't we? You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we're right back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London is 18:06, which means it's 13:06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Gavin McFadden, the director for the Centre of Investigative Journalism, and Geoffrey Kaufman, London-based correspondent, or former London-based correspondent for ABC News, and a good friend here of us all on Monocle 24. Welcome both to the programme. We're going to start, of course, with Ukraine, where so much has changed in such a short amount of time. Over the weekend, Ukraine's parliament voted to impeach President Viktor Yanukovych. He then fled the capital. The former prime minister, Julia Tymoshenko, was released, and now the focus turns to where Ukraine and the surrounding world will go next. Russia's Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev has today called the new leaders armed mutineers. Gentlemen, you know, it's an interesting moment. Geoffrey, why do you laugh?
Well, I mean, it's just so transparent, what Russia's agenda and you know, the indignation. Wait a minute, we were meant to be reveling in the glory of our Olympics, and suddenly it's been hijacked by this, I guess you call it the Russian Spring or the Ukrainian Spring. You know, this was not meant to be the way things were to go this weekend for the Putin dynasty, and they clearly aren't happy. But let's face it, I to me, what this shows us is that when the Berlin Wall fell in 89, we thought the Cold War was over, but it is very much alive and well, and it's very much we're seeing it in evidence in Ukraine.
Gavin, how tense do you think the situation really is between the West and Russia, with Ukraine sitting in the middle as the current hot potato?
I think the temperature is quite low on an international level. In Ukraine, of course, it's very, very hot. But I think the difficulty is that there's not a clean side in this horrible fight that's killed so many people. Both sides are deeply corrupt. Tymoshenko herself was sentenced to 7 years in prison for embezzlement. They only got rid of the charges against her by changing the laws. The present government is a murdering, pillaging operation. The two of them together is a pretty formidable unpleasantness. I wasn't at all surprised to see at a monument to Vlad the Impaler, a Ukrainian group celebrating Vlad. And I thought, that's not a very good sign for the future.
Geoffrey, when you just look at, you know, what could potentially happen now, you know, whether Russia tries to encourage separatism in the south, or whether, you know, it seems very unlikely they'll send any troops across the border at this point. But the reality is, you can't be too jubilant if you're on the incumbents' side in Kiev, because in the end, you need to have some kind of, you know, strategic deal with both Russia and the EU. That's the bit they haven't found, this kind of balancing act.
They need oil and gas from Russia just to keep the lights on.
And they need
on
the cash, and they're their neighbors and they're big trading partners. And
I think you actually hit on it. I think that this is now for the NATO alliance a moment of truth. If they want to help Ukraine move towards the West, it's going to be about cash. The country is in desperate financial straits, needs billions and billions instantly. Russia had offered them $15 billion, and that was actually a couple of weeks ago, and that was actually what set off this whole series of events that led to the violence this weekend, or the last week. The U.S., Europe, NATO allies are going to have to cough up much more than twice that in order to have an investment and to give Ukraine a way to return to the West. This is very much Putin did not want to lose. He has watched, as all Russians have in the last 20, 25 years, watched the great Soviet empire disintegrate and gravitate towards the West. You know, the Eastern European countries joining the European Union or joining even the Euro. And now we're seeing them, the Russians trying to hold on to really one of the most important pieces in the chessboard, Ukraine, which sits at the crossroads of the former Soviet Union and Western Europe.
Gavin, when you look at what's happened over the last few days, first of all, you know, as Jeffrey was referring at the top to, you know, the Winter Olympics, it did seem actually it ended with a moment of humour from the Russians about playing up the fact that their lights hadn't gone on correctly during the opening ceremony. They made a reference to it in a jokey way to a dance number at the end. It could have been a great moment for Russia, but we are seeing this old Russia, aren't we? And I wonder where that leads to, because there may not be troops over the border, but it's exactly the same language we saw before troops did go into South Ossetia. They crossed the border into Georgia, and Georgia has like two lumps of its country now, Abkhazia, you know, near Sochi, and South Ossetia, which it hasn't got control over. I wonder if the same could happen in Crimea or could happen in Sebastopol. I wonder if you think that there is a way that that country could now fracture.
I think that is possible, but it's possible for reasons that we don't hear much about. One of them is that Ukraine is one of the most important arms exporters in the former Russian bloc. They make MiGs there, Kalashnikovs on a gigantic scale, RPGs, all that stuff, which when you buy it illegally in Europe, you buy it largely from those sources. So it's a security question for the Russians, I think, that this vast supply of munitions, so usually infantry, light weaponry, is available now everywhere in that region if it spirals out of control. And the reason I would say that's particularly important is because Transparency International describes Ukraine as the third most corrupt country in the world. It's described by the former head of the CIA as a total kleptocracy, that the level of theft was equal to or worse than Nigeria, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the institution that the Russians want to put money into or the Americans or the EU want to put money into. So there's a lot of scope there for Jeffrey. Terrible fraud.
There is, you know, you mentioned a moment ago, Gavin, that there's no clean side, but there is actually a third way, and that's Vitaly Klitschko, this extraordinary character, this 6'10" is he, former heavyweight boxer champion, who has now emerged as the bridging leader. And who, if you can understand his somewhat mangled English over the weekend, says that he's a wealthy man, that he doesn't need the money. And if you want to believe him, he is emerging as the possible leader of the pro-European faction. And I think that you have to. This is a country of 45 million people. It is huge. It is a big player and it's important. And clearly, in the western part of Ukraine, there is a strong pro-European sentiment, and it's not prepared to be suppressed any longer. That's why we've seen people in the horrific violence, just chilling violence we're seeing on the streets, put their lives in front of guns in order to stand up to this kind of Soviet imperialism of days gone past.
I think the funny thing is that you both reference that. You know, I've only been to Kiev once a couple of years ago, and I was, in fact, in a room with Mr. Klitschko, because what was interesting is it was the opening actually of an art gallery, but actually everybody you'd ever heard of who was Ukrainian, if there'd been a kind of an intro in Eurovision or whether there'd been a former prime minister, they were all in the one room, because you realise it was a very tight group of people who had the power and the money in that country. And there was a small collection of oligarchs, and those people had made billions out of the dissolution of the Soviet Union. It didn't feel like a country with a very broad middle class, not even like Russia. And when you see what's happening now, that's what we don't see, is we don't see the businessmen who have got a real interest in how this kind of plays out as well, Jeffrey.
You know, I was there for the first time in the 90s, and I went to Donetsk, to Kiev and Donetsk, which is the coal mining town in the east that is now very much in the Russian orbit. And it was a really sobering look at what Russian and so former Soviet poverty looks like. I mean, these were people who were going out in the middle of winter with buckets to a well and dropping the bucket down in a way that seemed kind of quaint in a sketch from 200 years ago, but just barbaric today. And the extremes of poverty then still exist now. And you're right, the so-called democratization of Ukraine has not in any way raised the standard of living for most of those 45 million people.
That's entirely right. Yeah.
Gavin, a rare stumble for Putin in recent months?
Yeah, I think so. But on the other hand, it was inevitable, one form or another. I think he plays a very delicate balancing game, and he seems to have been very successful at playing to American weaknesses and expropriating them as best he's able. We've seen some illustrations of that in the recent time, but this is a bad example for him because his guy is killing a lot of people.
Well, I was reading that he was incensed that the Russians didn't make it past the quarterfinal in the hockey. It's impossible not to talk about the Olympics when you talk about this story.
thought that he was even going to play, wasn't there, at one point?
But you've got to imagine if he was incensed that the Russian hockey team was eliminated, he's got to be even more incensed about his control over Ukraine.
Let's just look at Sochi before we move on. Jeffrey, a success for Putin?
You know, I mean, you have to admit it. It was. I mean, it went smoothly. It was a bit warm. The snow was a bit mushy, but there were no security issues. All the talk about inadequate facilities and residences for the athletes being unfinished and hotels being unfinished evaporated the first day. And it was very much reminded me of the London Olympics, because all we heard about in the days up to the London Olympics were how everything wasn't ready. And then, bang, things went well. Yeah, you got to give him credit for that. The question is, what's the real legacy beyond his ego? And, you know, I don't know whether you've seen these pictures of the Athens Olympic facilities that are floating around the internet right now and how they've all decayed. And it's really, really crushing. If you haven't seen them, just Google them. But
Sarajevo doesn't look so hot.
Sarajevo would be another one. But, you know, is that the fate for Sochi? And given the fact that the place, it's February, and the place can't keep snow, you got to wonder whether it was a good place to actually hold the Winter Olympics.
Gavin, if you were standing there on the edge of the ice watching Mr. Putin and he was a skater, 10 out of 10?
No, 4 out of 10.
4 out of 10. Oh, you're a tough judge.
You're a tough judge. You got to give him at least 6.
No, but actually the administration of the Olympics seemed extraordinary on the surface of it. I mean, except the cost was staggering. They built in record time by spending enormous sums of money.
And the environmental consequences
we're
hearing about.
Yeah, will be disastrous.
It's funny, both the Winter Games and also the Games that were held here, obviously the Summer Olympics held in London. London kind of got off to a good start because of the opening ceremonies. Russia kind of stumbled. But Russia pulled it out the hat in a bit with that closing ceremony. Whoever was the choreographer with that little bit of wit with the dance routine at the end, it kind of poked fun at themselves. It kind of... But there was something about those opening ceremonies, again, that chimed quite well with people, didn't you think?
Yeah, I mean, the wit at the end, we don't tend to think that Russians have a good sense of humor about their own failings. And I think you got to tip your hat to them. The fact that someone had the courage to make fun of a misstep that was mocked around the world really was a pretty brave thing. And, you know... Of course, everybody has to be relieved that there was no violence. I mean, you know, only a fool would celebrate something going terribly wrong at those Olympics. So I think you have to give Russia credit. They did well. The question is, as a leader, has Putin really done anything more than raised his own profile and improved his own self-image?
And the other credit to them is that you do realize, yeah, how much the kind of the media in the West were desperate for it to go wrong. It was like, you know, we were praying for the sunshine. We were praying for everything to kind of happen that could kind of trip them up. And then when it kind of didn't.
I don't know whether you caught it, though. It's interesting. NBC, the American broadcaster, which has Olympic rights, was much criticized for turning a blind eye to the whole issue of human rights and environmental issues and the kind of heavy-handedness in which these Olympics were orchestrated. Bob Costas, one of their commentators on Friday, delivered a searing indictment of Putin and Russian laws and Russian tolerance before signing off. And it, to his credit, I mean, you know, clearly they waited to the end because I guess they were afraid the signal would be pulled. But I think you have to give NBC credit. They didn't turn a complete blind eye. They just chose their moment.
Well, it's certainly been the big story of the weekend, the closing of the Winter Games in Sochi. And the opening of all sorts of events in Kiev. We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Gavin McFadgen, and also Jeffrey Kaufman. When we return, we'll look at free expression in Turkey and gay rights in Uganda.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favorites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favorites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Gavin McFadgen of the Centre for Investigative Journalism and Jeffrey Kaufman. Fresh protests have erupted in Istanbul as the public take to the streets to campaign against the government's proposed internet law. The law will allow the government to block websites, store personal data, and effectively endanger people's privacy without a court's decision. The opposition alleged the move will help Erdogan's administration stifle the corruption scandal that emerged in December. President Gül is yet to ratify the law. Gavin, we'll start with you on this. What's interesting is, you know, you only go back, you know, 2 years. Turkey was the bright spot, you know, the economy doing well. It was the centre for diplomacy in the Eastern Med and beyond. Turkish Airlines, you know, which still is kind of, you know, joining up the world from Istanbul. It seemed to be a renaissance in the arts and culture. Everything was going nicely. Now everything's fallen apart from, you know, on the diplomatic front. This huge kind of scandal that's surrounding Erdogan. But what do you think is going to happen now? Because it really is kind of beginning to stumble a little bit, modern Turkey, isn't it?
It is, but it's been stumbling off and on for many years. My first trip to Istanbul was in 1969 to address the question of torture of political prisoners in Turkey. And we were interviewing people just out of prison. And the level of brutality was almost incomprehensible. They practiced something called falaka, where they beat people's soles of their feet until there was nothing left inside. And that went on for about 35 years. And this regime comes at the very end of that period. And the people who did most of that was a group called the MIT, which was a sort of secret police, which is behind Erdogan and some of the others. And the secret police had another group of civilians working for them called the Grey Wolves. And one of their members was famous for trying to assassinate the Pope a few years back, Mehmet Ali. But that regime that represents all that over a 50 or 60 year period hasn't really changed that much. The political complexion has changed because I think most Western correspondents want to see this as a Muslim anti-Muslim split, when in fact it has a great deal more to do with Ataturk and the modernization of Turkey than not. And that hasn't succeeded. And so those two contending forces are still at war.
In a way, there's an echo of what's happening in Ukraine, I guess, Jeffrey. It's, you know, which way do you face? That's the question for Turks. You know, there are the Turks who want to face, you know, literally to Mecca and for religion to become a more important part of the way that the state is run. And there are those who look to Europe and crave something that's secular and that's about business and contemporary values. They're torn.
It's true. And I think what's interesting and what's alarming about what's happening in Turkey is that, you know, when I covered the Arab Spring, I would often say to people, so, you know, what do you want? And they say, we want freedom. And then they say, we want democracy. And I say, well, so what does democracy look like to you? And the people in North Africa, in the Middle East, have real difficulty understanding what an Arab Muslim democracy, or I should say Muslim, not Arab democracy, looks like. And they say, well, Turkey. But of course, Turkey is not like Libya. It's not like Egypt. It's much more secular. It's much more at the crossroads of Arab and Western worlds. And what we're seeing now is that they are having real trouble reconciling those two worlds. And Erdogan's movement really pulls them back to what is a quasi-dictatorship under the veil of democracy. And this flashpoint of internet laws, which basically allow the government to snoop, is simply one push too many on the people to constrain their rights and to allow the government to control and to look at what they're doing and really kind of a secret police.
And what's interesting, I guess, is that President Gül has always been seen as this kind of character who's more moderate, kind of like better at kind of, you know, getting a kind of more consensus opinion. And he certainly hasn't passed, you know, ratified the law yet. And there is some hope, I guess, that he will try and push back against it. But I guess the seam of trouble that, you know, Erdogan can't dodge is this huge corruption scandal. It seemed to involve his family. You know, so many people were raided, ministers did step down. But he instead turned against the police and he's trying to kind of crush any kind of dissent. And that's in the end, I guess, where you begin to kind of create an opposition for, you know, to what you're doing.
And you're right. And there's where the parallels with Ukraine are so raw, because what we're seeing now with Yushchenko out of office is just how grandly, how obscenely grandly he was living while his country was in squalor.
We'd all like a galleon on our personal lake, wouldn't we?
and his private golf course, etc. But I've never seen so much gaudy gold in my life as his. But you know, these leaders who make life comfortable for themselves, their families, and their friends. It is the same story, and you know, whether it's in Latin America, Africa, or these countries. And at some point, in some of these countries, the people rise up. And yes, Erdogan, that's in fact, this internet law seems to be, the flashpoint isn't just individual rights, civil rights. It's also, there's a sense there's a conspiracy here to stop people talking about this corruption investigation, that they can, that the police and the secret police and the government will be able to suppress this talk of Erdogan's circle being so corrupt if they can just control the chatter on the internet.
Well, we've got time to fit in one more story before the bottom of the hour. And we're going to turn to Africa, where President Museveni of Uganda has signed it into legislation, an anti-gay and anti-lesbian law that will criminalise homosexuality and its promotion, which is always a strange word in association with homosexuality. But anyway, members of the LGBT community could face life imprisonment. This was despite the efforts of America to dissuade Museveni of this course of action. I wonder, what do you think, Gavin? Do we just cut them off and just say, actually, let's end all this niceties? You know, we always pretend that every country's kind of, you know, system and laws are its own business and we don't mind and they're all equal value in the end. Actually, is it just time to say, you know, that we give you a ton of money, you need our support, and if you don't want to kind of abide by a few kind of human rights laws, goodbye?
Well, I think that may actually happen, because Eric Holder visited the country recently and suggested that it was like, in a way, like Ukraine, it was a kleptocracy almost beyond description. And I think that's certainly true. And I think the punitive laws that he seeks to endorse and support and magnify, in fact, are a cover for corruption on a gigantic scale. Just like in Ukraine, Uganda is a horrendously corrupt place where something like 43 or 44% of the entire gross national product of the country goes into corruption, goes into the pockets of a tiny handful of people. And of course, what's significant and difficult about this is that it was always supported by the Americans and the British, and that these very laws that he's trying to put in place were the old colonial British laws against homosexuality. And those are never, 38 countries in Africa have laws built by the Brits against homosexuality, and of which these are the worst. But it's indicative of a whole current of British-educated dictators who produce this kind of ghastly material.
And this is the classic wedge issue. You know, we've talked about this before around this table, but this is, you know, in the U.S. until recently, gay rights was a very effective wedge issue for Republicans, as recently as George W. Bush, to galvanize their right-wing base. And it was very effective. And I think the Republicans, we'll talk about it another time, are going to have to face a new reality on that issue in the next election, as they did in the most recent one. But in Africa, it's a very effective way, as Gavin says, to distract distract people from bigger issues. But I do want to say that there's something else beyond economic sanctions that the U.S. can do, and that is that they can figure out a way to control these extreme zealots, these Christian missionaries who, having lost the battle back home and in the continental U.S. on gay rights and gay marriage, have now decided that they will go to places that are poor and defenseless and have huge social problems beyond this, and distract people with this talk of Sodom and Gomorrah. And so much of this, in particular in Uganda, is driven by American so-called missionaries who are spreading their vision of the gospel, which includes this. And they have really been at the root of this. And you know, somehow dealing with the issue of liberty and freedom, which can't be dismissed in this case, the U.S. has to somehow figure out how to deal with this. Because, in fact, this is actually an American-born virus.
Well, to some degree.
But to some degree, yes. Yeah, I wouldn't say extremely, but
I agree with you. I think that's entirely right. I mean, the missionaries play a role that if it was heard in Britain or America, it would horrify people.
Right. And if the missionaries, while it's true that those values existed, it's the missionaries who've gone in and amplified
right.
them.
Absolutely right.
Gentlemen, we're going to have to leave it there. Lots and lots more we could talk about on that subject. Gavin McFadgen of the Centre for Investigative Journalism and Jeffrey Kaufman, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. Plenty still to come in the second half of today's show. Our woman in Caracas will bring us up to speed on the protests in Venezuela, and we'll speak to the producer of a new Oscar-nominated documentary called The Lady in Number 6. But before we get started on all of that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest world news headlines.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, eu sou o London. This is Monocle 24.
Outlondo, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London, Europe.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Ukraine's Interior Ministry says a warrant has been issued for the arrest of the former President Viktor Yanukovych. He's been removed from power and is wanted after ordering the crackdown on protesters last week that led to more than 70 deaths. The 63-year-old has fled the capital Kiev but is still at large. The Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi promised to cut labour taxes, free up funds for investments in schools and pass sweeping institutional reforms ahead of a confidence vote in his newly installed government on Monday. Facing Parliament for the first time, 39-year-old Renzi, Italy's youngest ever prime minister, detailed an ambitious programme of change. Joint military exercises involving the United States and South Korea are underway despite protests from North Korea, which described the manoeuvres as a rehearsal for an invasion. They started as more than 300 South Koreans met family members in North Korea's Mount Kumgang resort. And Greece has resumed bailout talks with its international lenders on Monday, hoping to end 6 months of wrangling over the release of new rescue loans it needs to avoid a default. As the meeting of the three inspectors with the country's finance ministers began in Athens, laid-off government workers protested outside, forcing the troika to enter through a side entrance of the finance ministry. And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Jonathan. And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we turn to Venezuela. Irene Caselli is our woman on the ground in Caracas, and she joins us on the line. Welcome to the show, Irene. Well, certainly Venezuela big in the news in the last few days with these protests. Could you just tell us exactly what's happening? There seems to be a sense that they're kind of spreading across the country, and the more of them are now taking place in Caracas. Perhaps you could just tell our listeners exactly what they're about and how big these demonstrations are.
Protests started in early February outside of Caracas. They were initially protests carried out by students who were complaining about the insecurity situation here in Venezuela, as well as the tough economic situation with shortages of food staples, as well as a very high inflation rate. They then spread to Caracas, and on the 12th of February, there was the first big march in Caracas, which was also supported by one one of the opposition leaders, Leopoldo López. That day, on the 12th of February, three people died as a result of the protests. And that gave protesters one more reason to be out in the streets. At least two people who died were killed, were shot dead by members of Venezuela's security forces. They are not currently being investigated, and it's unclear what the situation will be. So the protests right now continue across the country. Caracas has seen daily protests, and on Monday it woke up with very early protests, with people banging pots and pans and also trying to close down roads into Caracas.
Now, the opposition leader, Enrique Capriles, has made it clear that he doesn't believe this is a moment we're going to see the government fall. So what are the ambitions of the demonstrators?
Well, the demonstrators keep saying that they won't leave the streets until President Nicolas Maduro resigns. Enrique Capriles, the leader of the opposition that ran against Nicolas Maduro in last year's presidential elections, he seems to be more of a moderate voice within the opposition. He believes in dialogue, it seems, but many leaders and people in the streets have a very different position. I've spoken to people that have even come to tell me that they'd be willing to have a foreign invasion in the country if the president was not to resign, because they believe that the government of President Nicolas Maduro is a dictatorship rather than a democratic government. Of course, this is not a position that is shared by a majority, but so far it seems that this sort of hardline minority is making a lot of noise here in Venezuela.
Now, President Maduro seems to be rather upset with the media and is lashing out at them, blaming them for what's going on.
That's right. Over these past few weeks, as protests have been ongoing, the government has already taken off the air a Colombian TV station that the government accused of broadcasting the violent protests and inciting to violence. The government has also been very vocal against other media, for example, the AFP news agency and even CNN. The president himself has said that CNN is responsible for inciting violence as well. There was a bit of a confused situation at some point as he threatened to expel CNN Español specifically. That's the Spanish language service of the U.S.-based TV channel. And one of the reporters, the reporter based here, had her accreditation revoked for a day or so. Then she had her accreditation back, but the situation seems still sort of unclear at this point in time.
And I believe that it's also trickling through into the arts world as well.
That's right. It seems that people are upset at anyone who's not saying things out loud against the government. So one of the probably most famous figures in the art world when it comes to Venezuela, Gustavo Dudamel, he's the director of the Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra. And he's one of the products of a famous music program here in Venezuela called El Sistema, which provides music education to kids around the country. Now, there's been an open letter sent to him by a pianist, Gabriela Montero, based in the United States. She actually compared Dudamel to the quartet that was playing music as the Titanic sank. And she said that in that case, music didn't save people, and that she thought it was a high time for Dudamel to speak out against this regime. Now, El Sistema is government-funded, and Dudamel actually responded by saying that he was playing for the people, and he believed in peace, and he didn't believe that there was any need to make any statements. And that's not all of it. Nicolas Maduro has also had a bit of a back and forth with one of the most famous salsa singers here in Latin America, Rubén Blades, who's actually been outspoken against the government. And President Maduro has told him that he's not got the vision of Venezuela quite right, and he's probably being badly influenced by international media.
And finally, can you just tell me, for you, as you go about your business in the city, are you aware of these demonstrations? Is it something that's impinging on daily life in the city?
It depends on which part of the city you live in. In the eastern part of Caracas, which is where basically it's an opposition stronghold. For example, on Monday morning, we woke up with roadblocks and students burning garbage. Several roads have been blocked. Several people are stuck in traffic. There's been also some more dramatic situations of ambulances that haven't been able to get through these roadblocks. So it is something that does influence you and affects your daily life, depending very much on which part of the city you live in.
Irene, great to catch up with you. That was Irene Caselli, who is our correspondent in Caracas, Venezuela. Up next, we'll speak to the producer behind the Oscar-nominated documentary, The Lady in Number 6. Stay tuned.
The Singapore Air Show is a magnet for the world's most important aerospace companies, all of them eager to sell to the high-flying Asia-Pacific market. Monocle got strapped in to gauge the state of the soaring industry.
The requirements for new military equipment here are vast and include not only combat and surveillance aircraft, but tankers and transports as well. Patrolling maritime borders was, however, one of the more dominant themes, and that's no surprise given current tensions in the region.
Pushington at the 2014 Singapore Air Show, premiering in the Films menu on Monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Let's turn now to a new documentary film that explores an inspirational life, that of Alice Hertz Sommer, who died yesterday at the age of 110. The documentary, The Lady in Number 6, looks at how Alice Sommer used music as a means of survival, playing recitals on the piano during her time in Theresienstadt concentration camp and going on to become a renowned concert piano player after the Second World War. At the time of her death, she was thought to be the oldest survivor of the Holocaust. One of the producers of the documentary, Frederick Bobo, joins me now. Welcome to the show, Frederick. An amazing film, this, and a sad piece of timing, because obviously the nomination for the film coming up. Can you tell us, first of all, how this film came about to being made?
Well, it came about, I made it with a bunch of people, but Malcolm Clark is the director of the film. And we met, we were working with a pianist, a concert pianist named Caroline Stossinger in New York, and she knew Alice. And she told us about Alice repeatedly over a couple of years. And then when Malcolm finally met her, he was very smitten, and we raced to get it done. This was when she was 107, but we didn't know that she would live on to 110.
Now, I guess the most amazing thing, and everybody who's seen this film or who's commented on it, whatever you read, it's about her kind of, her as an individual. She had a kind of a belief in there was a way through things. She had a kind of calmness after the terror that she went through. She lost much of her family during that period. Is that what drew you all to the story as well? This Zen-like, this kind of incredible sense of purpose that she has as well.
Absolutely. We debated a lot when we were editing it and when we were trying to figure out what to make of it, that this was not, to us, a Holocaust film. It was a film about a woman with an extraordinary, or three women, but mainly Alice, with an extraordinary perspective on the world and their life and life in general. And their experiences fed In part, their experiences fed those things. But Alice, I think, was like that, maybe from birth or something. But certainly, it wasn't the Holocaust that made her like that. She had an extreme optimism and view of the world that was different than everyone else, I'm sure, before she went through that experience. It only helped her survive those experiences.
And she was clear that music had been fundamental to her ability to survive the many things that she went through. And as you as filmmakers and you met her, did you understand why that had helped her so much?
I think so. I mean, I'm not a musician, and I'm certainly no musician to the caliber of Alice or Anita. Lasker Wellfish is also in the film. But Anita, at one point, speaks of understanding music on such a level that even if you're stuck in a camp or in a prison or any terrible situation, you can replay that music in your head. You have an understanding for it. You can hear it in your head, and it's a way of giving you some sanity in an insane situation.
Well, we have a clip from your film. This is Alice in her own words.
Every day in life is beautiful. Every day. It's beautiful.
To the residents of this small apartment building in North London, Alice Summer is the lady in number 6.
My world is music. I am not interested in anything else. The music is so beautiful.
Alice lives alone. She still has her health, and at 109, she feels she's the luckiest person alive.
I love people. I love everyone. I love people. I love to speak with them. I'm interested in the life of other people.
An amazing clip there, Frederick. When you listened to that, and when you made this film, I understand the film isn't packed with kind of images of the gas chambers or of the terrible things that she would have seen and been witness to. In fact, you tried to make a film that, you know, without naivety, is a positive film. Did you feel that was important to her legacy?
Very much so. I think Alice is all about positivity. She speaks in the film about even the bad things in life can be beautiful if you know where to look. And I think that's what enabled her, that's her optimism that enabled her to survive so many things. I mean, she lost her entire family in the Holocaust, and her son died when he was 65 years old, you know, who was really the central figure in her entire life was her son. So her optimism, you know, her son died. Basically, he played a concert, went to the hospital, took an anesthetic to do some, I'm not sure what, some verifications, and he never woke up. And she sees that as a positive way to, at least he didn't suffer, he didn't know he was going to die, he didn't have to prepare for it, he went to sleep and never woke up, and she sees the positive side of that.
And Frederick, tell me, what did it feel like when you got the nomination for the Oscar? How do you get an Oscar nomination? Do they email you? Do they give you a phone call?
No, they announce it in Hollywood or somewhere in L.A., in Beverly Hills or something. On January 16th, they announce all the nominations individually over a few hours. And our producer, Nick Reed, who's in L.A., was there waiting. We knew we were shortlisted, so it didn't come out of completely nowhere. I mean, we were lucky to have been one of 8 films shortlisted and now one of 5 nominated.
But excitement?
I'm sorry?
But it made you, is it a moment of excitement when something like that comes through?
Yeah, I think it was a moment of stunnedness on some level. You know, we did this film, really, Malcolm met Alice, and she was 107 at the time, and he said, we need to do this fast, we can't wait for funding. So we just, Nick Reed in L.A. got us some funding just to fly to L.A., fly to London, and get a cameraman and sound people and hotels and whatnot. But other than that, the whole film was done on a volunteer basis. None of us were paid, the editor, the composer, everyone worked for free, because everyone was just enamored with, fell in love with Alice. So, you know, it's exciting, this Oscar situation, because it's bringing her story to an audience that we could never have reached otherwise.
Well, Frederick, for both your pleasure and also for the memory of Alice, his hoping that you win. That was Frederick Bobo, who is the executive producer of The Lady in Number 6, and many thanks to him for coming on the show. Let's take a quick break and listen to some music. Some music played, in fact, by Alice Herz-Sommer whilst in Theresienstadt concentration camp. This is Chopin's Revolutionary Etude. Well, that was Revolutionary Etude by Chopin. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we're approaching the end of the programme. But of course, before we go, it's time for our daily review segment, where we go through the best in books, theatre, art, music, cinema, and many other topics too. Today we talk art with Scott Rayburn, who's the art market correspondent for the International New York Times here in London. Scott, thank you very much for coming on the show. And let's jump straight in. I'm slightly jealous. I think you've been to see the Cartier-Bresson show, which is just opened at the Pompidou Centre. It's had a huge amount of publicity. It's a massive, massive show. Some of the reviews I've read have said it's interesting because you look at the work and in a way it makes you realise that this is a period of photography that's well and truly over. It's come to an end. We've moved on to a digital world. You know, people snapping things on their camera phones. And here was this man who took a huge amount of time taking photographs, looking for this pivotal moment always. And perhaps it's come to an end. Do you think that's true?
I think that's one of the huge attractions of the exhibition and why it's so popular. All Paris exhibitions are popular. They love their art, and so it's quite difficult to get to the actual images. But I think what it represents, certainly to Parisians, is a lost Paris. But rather more importantly, I think it represents a lost way of seeing. I think people are really drawn to this exhibition because Bresson was obsessed with what he called the decisive moment. And when we take photographs, I don't know about you, we just blaze away with a digital camera or let it go on video. And it's a completely different way of looking at the world and bringing it alive. And I think that's what's so incredibly memorable about this artist, not just a photographer.
But do you think that's a lesson that photographers and viewers and people should take away and think should be, you know, revived or kept alive in some way? Or do you think that, you know, great, but it's gone?
I think most people who go to the exhibition will be looking at it and thinking, I should look harder at the world and be more observant. I think actually, because of the digital world, I think we've become probably quite visually lazy. And what Bresson does is creates this tremendous sense of looking at the world anew, particularly just ordinary moments all around us, which he brings to life.
Now, because those photographs are so famous and because they're kind of etched in our mind, often as quite beautiful images, we kind of forget the story of the man. And it was just reading about him before coming on the show today that, you know, a communist, you know, unsure about his wealthy background, you know, a bit of a revolutionary. And somehow, I guess, we forget the man's story a bit when we look at those images.
No, I think that also is a strength of the exhibition. You could just sort of bung all these images up on a wall, which in a sense would be just, you could look at them in a book. But what the exhibition emphasises, I think, are two important strands. His links with surrealism, which makes you, once you look at a few surrealist images, you look at the world rather differently. And I think his links with communism spurred this sense of dignifying the ordinary. And I think those two strands, which the exhibition stresses, and stresses quite well and rightly, make more sense of his life as an artist, really.
Now, I understand there's some 400 or 500 pieces in the exhibition. Exhaustive or exhausting, seeing something like that?
Virtually all exhibitions at the Pompidou are completely exhausting. They're all two rooms too long. You know, and that is the case of virtually every exhibition. It could be done in just 100 images, but the French like to do it in the grand style.
Now, we'll come to the Gagosian Gallery, a show there which is called La Fine di Dio. Could you tell us all about this?
Well, first thing I want to say is that it's in a commercial gallery in Mayfair and David Street, and I'm as frightened as everyone else of commercial galleries. They're very intimidating places. There are guards on the front door. But if there's any commercial exhibition worth seeing, this is the one at the moment, because it's very unusual and packs a big punch. You go in and walk past the security guard, and then you see on the right a small boy in short trousers kneeling in front of a sort of pink altarpiece, and you walk towards it. Then you notice the altarpiece is an egg-shaped canvas that's been slashed very brutally. And then you look round, you notice that the schoolboy is in fact Hitler, a miniaturized Hitler kneeling in front of this painting. And this is a really fascinating piece of creative curating by a guy called Francesco Bonami, who's done quite a lot of curating with Damien Hirst. And he's just taken two pieces, this Maurizio Catalan figure called Him of Hitler, and then this earlier painting, 1960s painting by Lucio Fontana, one of the great sort of existentialist painters, conceptual painters of the 60s. Both are owned by Catalan, and he just put them together in a piece that's inspired by, he happened to be going to America to this army museum and noticed a slashed canvas of Hitler as a sort of Joan of Arc figure. And then his mind began to turn, making associations. And we put this slash canvas with a miniaturized Hitler. And it just has so many levels of resonance and poetry.
And how many other pieces in this curated show?
Just two.
Just two pieces?
There's just two. They're both owned by the artist, by a Catalan who made the Hitler. But it packs a tremendous punch. And he's made a work of art out of two other work of art.
Now, that's pretty unusual, isn't it, for a gallery to have such a small exhibition in a way. And the Gagosian isn't a small space either.
Well, this is his small Mayfair space. Oh, okay. Yeah, he has a huge gallery over in King's Cross, okay, but this is a small sort of boutique space.
And we'll stay with the kind of the world of, you know, commercial art and Art 14, which is opening later next week at Olympia. This show, we've touched on it already on Monocle 24. It's interesting because it's, you know, there are so many shows now, so many shows for collectors. And I know that they kind of, you know, they're not Frieze, because I guess Frieze is seen as the premier show now, both for contemporary art and also for old masters increasingly as well. They've slotted in, would it be fair to say they're slotted in just underneath that level?
No, that's fair. But the thing about Frieze is that it's an international fair. And so often with international artists, the visual language can turn into a sort of global Esperanto. What's I really like about Art 14 is that you have dealers at a slightly lower level, but you have a chance to, there are 182 galleries from 42 countries. You've got a complete global overview of art. And what gives the fair special interest? I think there are two aspects to it. Firstly, that the artists from wherever they are in the world tend to be actually coming out of some kind of local tradition. And secondly, you can buy stuff there. It's a much lower price point, £5,000. You can buy something really memorable.
Well, that is pretty amazing, because when you go to Frieze, as you say, the problem with Frieze, actually, you might see a Gursky on like 10 stands, and that they're all hundreds of thousands of pounds. And it is, you know, it is a world that's kind of slightly separated from us. Well that's great. So I think we'll go along and see what we can afford. Scott, thank you very much for coming in to see us. A really amazing rundown of the art world today. That's all we have time for on today's show. My thanks in particular to our special guests at the top of the show, Gavin McFadgen and Jeffrey Kaufman, and of course to Scott. And today's show was produced by Ala John. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Michaela Aitken. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Up next is Culture with Rob Bound, who's in conversation with the British-Swedish author Tom Rob Smith. He'll be telling Rob about his new book, The Farm.
In a strange sense, it's a thriller. It seems like an object that is very removed from my life, but it felt like it was really sort of scooped out of my soul.
This show is going to be back at the same time tomorrow, which is 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's time for me to say goodbye and thank you very much for listening.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.